Welcome to Your Call. I'm Ethan Elkind. About a dozen wildfires are currently burning in California. So far this year, more than 7,000 fires across the state have scorched more than 2 million acres of land. The Dixie Fire alone has been the biggest fire in state's history since erupting 50 days ago. Wildfires leave a lot of destruction in their path. Thousands of people have had to evacuate. Some have lost their homes, and certainly in years past, people have lost their lives. But what about the wildlife that gets left behind? What about their habitats? And what about endangered species? For the first half of today's show, we're going to discuss the ecological impacts of wildfires. How is wildfire smoke affecting animals and wildlife? And how do wildfires impact habitats and endangered species? So joining us now to discuss this topic is Allison Hermance, Director of Communications at WildCare, a wildlife hospital, nature education center, and wildlife advocacy organization located in San Rafael, California. Each year, they admit and treat as many as 4,000 ill, injured, and orphaned wild animals every year. Hi, Allison. Great to have you. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
And we're also joined by Justin Augustine, senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, a nonprofit organization that works to protect endangered species through legal action, activism, and more. Justin works specifically on endangered species and forest issues, and he previously worked as a wildlife biologist in multiple national parks. Justin, welcome to Your Call.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
So, Allison, I want to start with you. You've been working at WildCare for over 18 years. How are the intensifying wildfire seasons in California over recent years impacting our state's wildlife as a whole? How are the animals and habitats becoming greater victims here?
Well, it's an interesting question. So at WildCare in San Rafael, we are very fortunate that we have not actually had burned animals coming in. And our hearts, of course, go out to all of the centers like ours that are dealing with actual patients that come in because of the fires. What we're mostly seeing at WildCare is the effects of smoke on animals and just a general awareness of the smoke and the dryness and the heat causing problems for wildlife. It is absolutely impossible to think that the wildfires have not had a tremendous effect on wildlife. Obviously, animals that are within the burning areas or in the path of the fires or whose territories are in the areas that have actually been burned, those animals are going to be absolutely devastated. If you have an animal that lives in a small part of the forest and that's its habitat, then if that habitat burns, that animal has no options and no choices, to find another place, especially if it's a small territory that animal has. But I think in general, in areas that aren't specifically burned, the biggest risks are the dryness, the heat, and the smoke. In our wildlife hospital, which you're correct, does treat as many as 4,000 injured and orphaned animals every year, we was just looking at our statistics, and we're seeing a slight increase in the number of hit by car animals and the number of animals that fly into windows during the smokiest times. Certainly last year when we had those really, really, really dark smoky days, we saw an increase in that type of injury because I think just as humans, we're not breathing as well, we're not able to run as well, we're not able to see as well, and the smoke would impact animals in that way in the areas that are farther away from the fires. But it is the other consideration that we see a lot of is people putting out water for animals and that causing problems that are specific to putting out water. As soon as you put out a water source, you're creating an area for animals to meet up, which causes diseases to spread. It can cause aggression. And we have seen it also can bring animals into conflict with humans because of that proximity to human habitation where the water is placed. And we've seen an increase in injuries because of people putting out water for animals. So it's very variable. Obviously, again, the animals that are in the path of the fire are facing something completely different than those of us of all species facing the smoke from the fires. But there is no question that wildfires are absolutely devastating to wildlife and that recovery is going to be a real challenge for all wildlife species.
Well, Allison, that's a helpful tip about not leaving out water for wildlife, and we'll put some resources on that point on our website, yourcallradio.org. I wanted to follow up with you around the risk of animals inhaling wildfire smoke. We just did a show on Your Call the other week with public health experts who talked about what tiny particulate matter and smoke can do to our lungs as humans, and we know that animals breathe differently. Can you describe a little more specifically what animals are at risk of inhaling wildfire smoke and how it affects them more generally?
Sure. It's interesting because I don't know that we have a lot of science on it, but it obviously affects animals the same way it affects us. Mammals, like, you know, humans, of course, are mammals, and mammals breathe the way we do, where you inhale into your lungs using your diaphragm, and then there is the exchange of oxygen with carbon dioxide, and that's the exhale. So breathing those particulates into our lungs is terrible for us, and of course it's going to be terrible for all of the mammals, the other mammals that share our habitat as well. It's going to, you know, the same problems that we will face, including just the burning lungs and the streaming eyes that we deal with. The effect on birds is different, and I will be interested to see studies coming out about this. The way birds breathe is fascinating. If you want a really interesting read, do some Googling on how birds breathe. They don't have a diaphragm. They don't have lungs like mammals do, like we do. They have a series of air sacs throughout their bodies, even in their bones. And it's the movement of the bird's muscles that cause those air sacs to inflate and deflate with kind of like a bellows. And so, and that's how the bird breathes. Obviously, a bird that is more active is going to be breathing more. There's going to be more air moving through the bird's system. And a bird that is less active is going to have a less transmission of the polluted air through its system. But if you think about an animal like a hummingbird, I mean, the amount of energy that bird puts into flying and the tremendous amount of oxygen exchange that happens in that bird's body when you have heavy particulate in the air, there's no question that has to have a negative effect on the bird's body. WildCare has not, again, seen animals coming in specifically with smoke inhalation being the reason for admission to the wildlife hospital, but it would make sense that a bird like a hummingbird or any animal really, that especially one that depends on being able to run or fly fast away from a predator, is going to be inhibited by that particulate going into the lungs, going into the air sac system, and just building up and causing problems. It's just, it cannot be good for any of us.
Well, it's just fascinating to think about how birds breed. I probably was taught that back in high school biology, but forgot it if I ever learned it. And definitely interesting to think about how this affects different animals in terms of how they breed. I wanted to bring Justin Augustine from Center for Biological Diversity into the discussion. So, Justin, what are you seeing in terms of how intensifying wildfire seasons are impacting ecology? Because I know in some cases, some animals need or benefit potentially from wildfires to some extent. But what are you seeing in terms of the impacts here?
Thank you. And yeah, just first say thank you to Allison's organization, because it's, of course, heartbreaking when we see animals like bear cubs or bobcats that have been burned by the fire. And that's partly because, you know, there's so much human sprawl in our state forests these days that animals no longer have as many places to go to escape that they used to. But going back to your comment, I think what many people don't actually realize is that fire, much like rain, is an essential component for maintaining the biodiversity of California's forest ecosystems. And what it really boils down to is that fire creates habitat that nothing else can create. So, for example, when a fire burns, like some of the ones in the conifer forests of the Sierra Nevada this summer, it doesn't burn in a uniform way. Instead, the fire creates what we often refer to as a mosaic pattern, wherein some of the forest burns severely, well, some of the forest burns lightly or moderately. And it's that patchy outcome that creates different habitat types that are then used in multiple ways by different wildlife species. And so, for example, if part of the forest burns at low severity, that forest will then be used by rare species like California spotted owls that I work to protect. They'll use that part of the forest for nesting, but then they'll also use parts of the forest that have burned severely or moderately to go find their food when they're away from their nest. So the fire creates different types of habitats that really get used in different ways to help different species. And what's really interesting in the Sierras, at least in the Sierra Nevada Mountains, is that there are some species that actually specialize in using forest that is burned at high severity. there's a species known as the black-backed woodpecker that relies entirely on severely burned forest for both its nesting habitat and for finding food. And that's because those woodpeckers have evolved over thousands of years to be extremely adept at eating the beetles that are found inside dead trees that have been killed by a fire. And so while you and I might look out at that forest and just see dead trees and a barren ground, those woodpeckers look at that exact same landscape and they see a place to build a home, a place to find their food, and to raise a family. And it's not just woodpeckers. A year or so after a fire, we'll start to see lots and lots of vegetation growing. Wildflowers, lupins, nitrogen-fixing vegetation. And you'll see species like bees and hummingbirds using those wildflowers in a place that only a year before we saw as devastated. And so it's important to keep in mind that these places really do regrow in not just a small way, but in a magnificent way that's critical for the biodiversity, for the wildlife that we Californians love so much in the Sierra Nevada.
Well, Justin, I think you're raising a good point about, you know, the natural role of wildfires in our ecosystems. But haven't the wildfires in recent years just been much more severe than what nature has, you know, typically been able to handle? I mean, are we seeing extreme impacts from these climate-induced wildfires that are making this kind of regeneration more challenging for the species out there?
Well, climate change is definitely a factor here in creating at least larger fires and fires more often than we might have seen in the past. But it's not necessarily true that the outcome of those fires will not be important for wildlife. We don't really know yet what exactly the mosaic pattern is going to be from the, say, the Caldor fire or the Dixie fire. But from fires that have occurred in the recent past, such as the Rim fire in 2013, which was itself considered a mega fire, and other more recent fires, those places, if they're left unlogged, which is something, you know, my organization works to do, protect these places from logging, if they're left alone, we see them becoming amazing landscapes full of wildlife and biodiversity. So while it's true that we need to reduce climate change if we want to reduce the size and extent of fires, we shouldn't see the outcome as just being, you know, either good or bad. It's a really a mixed bag. And obviously, from a human perspective, these fires are devastating. But from a wildlife perspective, much of these fires can be seen as a benefit.
All right. Well, if you're just joining us, this is Your Call, and we're discussing the ecological impacts of wildfires and forest management. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. I want to open up the phone lines now. If you have a question or a comment on the impacts of wildfires and wildfire smoke on our habitats and species in the general ecology of the West here, you can join the conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org or reach us via Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. And we're joined today by Allison Hermance from WildCare and Justin Augustine from Center for Biological Diversity. Allison, I wanted to go back to you. So I'm curious, what's it been like at WildCare during this year's wildfire season so far? We know that there are a bunch of local wildlife centers that are doing this kind of rescue work throughout the state, like the Lake Tahoe Wildlife Center, which has been rescuing animals from the Calder Fire that's been raging in South Lake Tahoe area. But just this week, there have been some smaller fires in Sonoma County, close to where your organization's based in San Rafael. So what has the demand been like at WildCare so far?
Well, again, we're fortunate that we have not yet had patients coming in directly that are fire related. The main thing that we are prepared to do and that we have done in all of the fire seasons over the last several years is be ready to take in the wildlife hospital patients and also the educational animals from other centers that are directly in the path of the fires. So it is we have our doors open. We are ready for those centers if and when they need to actually evacuate their locations, wherever they are. That Santa Rosa Bird Rescue was one of the centers that came down last year, and we're ready to take those animals in. We did have a fire just actually a couple of blocks from my house, which is a little traumatizing for me. But it is, you know, we're keeping our eyes out, and we're telling people to keep your eyes out and be aware that there may be injured animals. But fortunately, in our area, they have been smaller fires, and animals must have been able to escape, or people just aren't finding them. You know, it's certainly people want to rescue and people want to be part of the rescue effort. But the fact is that being near a fire, unless you're a trained professional, is a very, very dangerous thing to do. So we tell people, please do not attempt to go into fire zones and rescue animals, but keep your eyes open, especially if there is a fire in the vicinity of your neighborhood. Keep your eyes open for animals in need. We say any animal that, we call it the five C's, any animal that is cold, crying, covered in blood, coming towards you, caught by a cat or a dog, those are all things to look for if an animal is injured. But basically an adult animal on the ground that lets you approach is an animal that needs assistance, that needs medical care. Any adult wild animal is going to fly or run away from you as a natural, just its natural behavior. So if an adult animal lets you get close to it, then that is an animal that does need help and does need to come into a wildlife hospital. And we do anticipate, oh, go ahead.
Well, Allison, I was going to ask, how hard is it to actually rescue a wild animal from these fires? You know, I'm thinking in particular of the heartbreaking video that I think many listeners probably saw, the black bear in Lake Tahoe, who was crawling on forearms. The bear's paws had been so badly burned that it couldn't walk or escape from the fire. And ultimately, I read that wildlife crews had to euthanize that bear because there was no way to transport it to rehabilitation center. So what's the process for actually rescuing wild animals like that in these fires?
Definitely depends on what species you're looking at. In the case of a black bear, you're going to want to call in professionals. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife is going to be your call for that. Your local animal control or humane society would also be an option for that. In general, if it's a larger animal, an animal with teeth or claws, then it's probably something that you're going to want to call for assistance. And actually, WildCare does have a hotline, 415-456-7283, that you can call, and we can help you get in touch with the person that would be in your area most capable of rescuing an animal like a black bear or a, you know, even a bobcat or a mountain lion. Obviously is not something you want to take on by yourself. But generally, you know, something like an owl, something like a hawk, something like a smaller animal. It's protecting your hands, protecting your eyes, having a carrier or box that's the right size available, and approaching gently, quietly, and generally scooping the animal up in a towel is often the best way to handle that rescue. Knowing where you're taking the animal is really important. So again, a call to WildCare or just a Google search for your local wildlife care center would get you that information. But I'm always amazed at how about approximately 80 or 85% of the wildlife patients that come into WildCare come in with members of the general public. And it's just a matter of getting over your fear, having hand cover and eye protection and a big towel and a box, and you're able to rescue that animal generally. Again, an adult wild animal can be a dangerous, any of any species can be a dangerous creature, but generally if the animal lets you approach, if you're able to get close enough to actually capture the animal, then that animal is in bad enough shape that the risk is minimized. So just being careful about it. I do recommend calling for advice, but certainly with that larger animal, and that bear story is just so heartbreaking, and it makes us all so sad to think of all of the animals that haven't been seen and haven't been rescued that are in that same condition. But you'd want to call in professionals in that context for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll put those resources up on our website, as I mentioned. Right. Justin Augustine from Center for Biological Diversity wanted to go to you to talk more about the impacts on endangered species. You talked a bit about some of the endangered species that might potentially benefit from the wildfires, but just last year, the fires throughout the West wiped out many populations of endangered animals. For example, in Washington, the fires killed about half of the state's endangered population of pygmy rabbits, also destroyed critical breeding grounds for the endangered sage grouse and sharp-tailed grouse. Can you just describe a bit about what you're seeing in terms of the impacts on endangered species across the West?
Sure. It's really a mixed bag. A fire, you know, creates habitat for some species, but then can have, you know, harmful effects on other species like you were just discussing. So I think from a broad perspective, you know, for obvious reasons, if we want to address the big picture fire scenario, we need to eliminate our reliance on fossil fuels, because that's really driving the weather conditions and whatnot that we're seeing in recent summers. But we should also, as we were discussing earlier, be cognizant of the fact that fire is absolutely essential. It's as essential as rain. So we can't, not only won't it go away, we don't want it to go away. And it's more about how much of it and where on the landscape it plays out, because in many places it's going to provide essential habitat for endangered species, whereas in other places it's going to destroy essential habitat for endangered species. So I think we have to just be very ecosystem specific and do our best in places like the Sierra Nevada to protect post-fire ecosystems. But in places like the shrub habitats of Southern California, where we have too much fire, we need to do our best to, you know, stop human ignitions and do as much as possible to reduce the fire outcomes that are causing harmful impacts to endangered species.
And Justin, what would your organization like to see? Any changes in terms of policy that you would like to see about better managing wildfires and the needs of habitats and endangered species?
Absolutely. After a fire occurs, at least in the forest ecosystems of the Sierra Nevada, our hope is that the policy will be to leave as much of those places alone as possible to allow the wildlife that needs them to use them, and to end post-fire logging as much as possible in our national forest, because from our perspective, that's still happening to a significant degree, and a lot of people don't realize that.
All right. And Allison, I wanted to get back to you. We just have another minute or two left here. How can people get involved with WildCare? I mean, you mentioned a little bit about what people should do if they find an injured animal, but do you have some specific tips, numbers they should call? What are some of the do's and don'ts there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do recommend everybody keep our phone number on file. That's our Living with Wildlife hotline, 415-456-7283. And that has a live person answering from 9 a.m. until 9 p.m., which can offer help with wildlife emergencies and situations like that. Our website, discoverwildcare.org, also has some great resources. And we do have some good information on there about, you know, whether or not you should put out water for wildlife, other issues that come up with you know, animals in any context. I think, it's the best thing to do is to keep your eyes open in your neighborhood and watch for animals in distress, because if you're looking, you're probably going to see them. And then whether you're close to WildCare in Marin County, or if you have another wildlife care center near to you, seeing animals in distress and getting them care as quickly as possible is really going to be one of the most proactive things that you can do.
All right. And Justin, final word to you. Any tips that you would recommend for people or policies that you would want people to get behind?
I think just one thing I'll say is that when folks are out in these burned forests, just be patient. And over the years, or even just a year after the fire, you will see a dramatic difference in what's out there. And I think a lot of people can actually come to love the wildlife that we find in these post-fire places.
All right. Well, and then we actually have a couple seconds left, so I'll ask you one last question. I have to ask, I'm curious, one of the goals of WildCare is to release wild animals back into their natural habitats, but what happens if those habitats have been burned or they're gone? Where do you release the animals in that situation?
That's a really good question. And it is, relocating wildlife is illegal in California. And it's because you're bringing animals that shouldn't be in an area into another area. And that causes all kinds of problems for both of those, the animals that live there and the animals that have been transported. So it's, I would assume that once we are in that situation, it will be a matter of finding the closest, most proximate location that has the same advantages as the area from which that animal came. But it is a very real issue and a very real hazard dealing with releasing wildlife. So it's I think we're going to have to wait and see on that and see what the best situation is. Of course, we do everything we can to get animals back to where they came from exactly. And if exact is not possible, then we will be able to do close enough.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you both for joining us. It's Allison Hermance, Director of Communications at WildCare, Wildlife Hospital, Nature Education Center, and Wildlife Advocacy Organization in San Rafael. Allison, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And I also want to thank Justin Augustine, Senior Attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, a nonprofit working to protect endangered species through legal action, activism, and more. Justin, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And we want to thank all of you for listening. If you have a question or comment, you can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or reach us via Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. We'll be back after this to talk about forest management and prescribed burning in our next segment. So please stay with us. This is Your Call. I'm Ethan Elkind. All right. If you're just joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call. You can join our conversation anytime by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or sending an email to yourcall@kalw.org. And we're also on Twitter at Your Call Radio. So we just had a really interesting discussion about the impacts of wildfires on the ecology of the West and endangered species. But now we're going to get an update on how California is doing with forest management. And right now, around a dozen wildfires are currently burning in California as firefighters are trying to contain the large burning Dixie and Calder fires up north and around the Lake Tahoe area. Many of us are monitoring that situation carefully. And joining us now are two guests to discuss what the state can do to try to lessen the impacts and the severity of wildfires. And first, we're joined by Don Hankins, a pyrogeographer and professor of geography and planning at California State University at Chico. He's also a Plains Miwok fire expert who studies indigenous traditional knowledge. Hi, Professor Hankins. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, and thanks for having me on.
Glad you can be with us. And we're also joined by Bill Tripp, Deputy Director of the Karuk Tribe's Natural Resources Department in Northern California. Bill, great to have you with us as well. All right, so we're just waiting on Bill. We don't have Bill quite yet, but hopefully he'll be chiming in a second. So Professor Hankins, let me start with you. The 2021 wildfire season so far in California is set to outpace 2020. There have already been over 7,000 fires across the state, which is pretty mind-blowing. It's scorching more than 2 million acres of land. And we know that there is a constellation of factors contributing to these deadly wildfire seasons, from climate change to extreme drought, and also a history of fire suppression in this state that's built up the fuels in our forests. So, Professor Hankins, how do you see these combination of factors influencing and determining some of the wildfire impacts that we're now seeing here?
Right. Well, I think for this year, one of the bigger impacts that we're really seeing is the effects of long-term drought, which is linked to climate change. You know, and then obviously the factors you point out around like forest stewardship and management of fuel loads and fire suppression, that all plays into it. And so, you know, in a typical year when I'm looking at fire in, say, the montane forested ecosystems of the Sierra Nevadas, typically you would expect, you know, in an area that's had fire within, say, the last 10 years, that those fires, where those footprints of those fires have been, would be more regulating of and self-limiting of new ignitions. So, for instance, in the case of the Dixie Fire, you know, we would expect that fires that happened in the footprint of the Feather River Canyon, where the fire had initiated at, that those fires would have limited the spread of it. So, you know, going back and thinking about fire history maps of like 2008, we had the Butte Lightning Complex that burned through portions of where this fire originated from. And, you know, the fuel loads were reduced in that spot because of those fires, but because of the drought conditions, you know, I think a lot of the ability for that fire to move through more drought-stressed vegetation and so forth, even though the fuels had been reduced by prior fire, it wasn't enough to slow it down and so forth in the way that we would normally expect. And so where we have seen those impacts have been more around places where fires have been more frequent, such as the 2020 Sheep Fire, which was closer to Susanville last season, and you know the fire has kind of crept around that particular area. So I think those are some of the major players, you know, pieces that kind of fit into this that we have to understand.
All right. Well, and we are now joined by Bill Tripp, Deputy Director of the Karuk Tribe's Natural Resources Department. Bill, welcome to Your Call.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, glad you can join. I wanted to get your reaction to what Professor Hankins just said, and basically, you know, ask you a similar question of what are you seeing in terms of the factors that are causing these ever worsening wildfires that we're seeing around the state.
Well, you know, it's increasingly obvious that climate change is a major factor. in the way fires are currently behaving. But one of the pieces that is just now starting to be, you know, discussed seriously is the absence of prescribed fire and cultural burning to maintain reduced fuel loading across the broader landscape. You know, historically, indigenous people have had a significant symbiotic relationship with fire to even be able to survive out in these places, and that's been removed from our environment. You know, there's been a multitude of factors leading up to today, fire exclusion being a primary one that's contributing to this, but you know, the legacy of extractive management principles and any number of other factors are definitely contributing.
Well, and Bill, you mentioned indigenous practices around prescribed fire. Can you describe a little bit about your tribe, the Karuk tribe up in Northern California? I mean, first you can just describe where it's located for listeners who aren't familiar, but also just what your traditional practices have been to handle fire. I know you've said that fire is sacred, so I'm interested in hearing more of your perspective on that.
Well, we're located in the extreme northwestern corner of California, in the Klamath River Basin and Salmon River watersheds. And so our territory extends from just over the California-Oregon border, down along the Klamath River to just above Witchpeck. So we've had, you know, a relationship with fire, a standing relationship with fire in this place for millennia. And, you know, it's used, you know, ceremonially and in utilitarian fashion and enhance resources, you know, from, you know, foods to fibers to medicinal resources. You know, of course, it's all of the different things that we would manage for with fire all have their own specific timing, different stand types, different elevations, slopes, aspects that one would be working on. And one of the things that really stands out, a couple of our sacred burns that were done annually as part of our world renewal ceremonies. You know, those were conducted on some low to mid elevation southwest slopes, which are the ones that carry the highest insulation values. And, you know, those fires were burned during the fire season. You know, the Black Mountain was burned in August, and Offield Mountain was burned in September. In fact, it would have been lit just yesterday. As part of the world, if we were still doing that as part of our world renewal ceremonies. Mm-hmm. And we don't have access to any kind of quality and abundant food and fiber resources without restoring that relationship with fire.
So it's really, really central to your cultural practices. And Professor Hankins, I wanted to ask you about some context on what Bill Tripp just described at the Karuk tribe. You've said that, I'm quoting here, colonization made California a tinderbox. Because for thousands of years, Native American tribes like the Karuk in California would regularly burn the landscape to steward the land. But in 1850, the California legislature actually passed a law that criminalized indigenous burning. Prior to that, indigenous tribes were burning around 4.5 million acres a year. Just for context, we've had 2 million acres a year burned in fires so far here. So they would burn, indigenous tribes have burned almost more than twice what we've already seen this year per year. So can you talk about this, the key indigenous knowledge behind burning and why it's going to be important ecologically for California going forward?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to kind of point into what Bill was talking about in terms of thinking about slope, aspect, the elevations, you know, all of those different factors play into the you know, kind of seasonal arrangement of fire within the landscape. Each vegetation community has a range of time periods of when it's appropriate to burn within it. And you know, not only is it the vegetation, but we're thinking about the interties with wildlife and what their activities are and, you know, what kind of outcomes we want to have from it. So if we think about, you know, different places within the landscape for folks, you know, maybe living in the lowlands, you know, that are grass dominated, they're going to have a specific time frame when it's going to be most appropriate to steward for grass production or flower production. And then, you know, as you move up to the higher country, you know, into the conifer forest, you're going to have a totally different time period for that, and the outcomes are going to be different because of that. So, you know, when we think about indigenous stewardship across the time periods, and you're, you know, referencing that, you know, roughly 2 million acres or so that's burned so far this year, you know, that's happened over the period of a few months, where for indigenous burning, that 4.5 million acres and going on up to, say, 12 million acres in drier times, as would be considered now, you know, that's happening throughout the year. It's not necessarily happening over the dry season as we're seeing it. So that's a really big difference to think about the seasonal timing as it's appropriate for different systems. And, you know, there's a calendar that people would kind of have in their mind about, okay, around this time of year, I should be over in this place. And, you know, these are the things that I should be looking for to tell me if it's ready to burn in that spot or not. And, you know, those practices are not able to be implemented, as Bill was talking about, simply because of access and policy and those sorts of things. And so, you know, going forward, I think if we're looking at bringing fire back into the landscape, you know, there's the choice of using prescribed fire, which is valid for like fuel reduction and, you know, wildlife habitat improvement. But if we're really thinking about trying to steward California in the way that indigenous peoples have stewarded since time immemorial, then we really need to be thinking about what are the cultural context of those fires, how does that relate to the ecology of place, and how do people then intertie to that? So when Bill mentions not having access to quality foods and fibers and medicines, that's all linked to the right timing of fire within place, and it's all very geographically centralized in that sense.
All right. Well, if you're just joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call. And you can join this conversation. We're talking about how California is doing on prescribed burns and forest management. Very pleased to be joined by Don Henkins, pyrogeographer and professor of geography and planning at Cal State Chico, and Bill Tripp, deputy director of the Karuk Tribe's Natural Resources Department in Northern California. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We want to hear what you have to say about prescribed fires. Would you like to see the state do more of them? Do you have concerns about potential downsides of prescribed fires? You can also send us an email at yourcall@kalw.org or reach us on Twitter at yourcallradio. Bill Tripp, we just heard from Professor Henkins about the need for more prescribed burning. Can you explain a little bit about how a prescribed burn actually works? How are they supervised? What methods are used? Can you just paint a picture for listeners as to how you go about what you do at the Natural Resources Department there at the Karuk Tribe?
Yeah. Well, there are two different things there. There's prescribed fire and then there's cultural burning. The prescribed fire, you know, is a really regimented process. It has to go through all of these. There has to be a burn plan in place that's been reviewed by a person with a specific set of qualifications, and it's typically carried out in a manner that gets you to the point of a certain target or percentage of consumption and all of these other factors that help protect you the burners from any potential liability if there's an escape. Whereas the you have a militaristic type structure where you have a burn boss and a firing boss and a holding boss, and then you might have some engine bosses that are running fire trucks and crew bosses that are running hand crews and on and on and on, that each person has their own role to play in carrying out that function. And that is a very efficient and productive, setup in a complicated situation. Mm-hmm. Now, with the cultural burning, it's a little bit different. You know, historically, families would just go out when the indicator showed themselves and they would do some burning. You know, we didn't have fire engines, but we had a frequently reduced fuel bed. So it wasn't all that complicated, you know. And so, you know, a person would just, or a few people could go out and you know, burn under, say, some black oaks in February or early March and create a black line for burning some grasses into in late June.
I appreciate you providing that distinction there between a prescribed fire and a cultural burn, and we will have more resources on our website for people interested in more details on that. We do have a caller on the line here, so I want to go to Chris in San Francisco. Chris, welcome to your call.
How do we educate the public? And I can answer my own question. How do we realize immediately the Native American Cultural Center on Alcatraz Island? So many people come through there from all over the world. We could really spread this knowledge. Thank you.
All right, Chris, I appreciate that question and response to your own question. Let's see, Bill, I wanted to go to you on this. What do you think about educating the public and what needs to be done?
Yeah, that's a great point about the mass amount of people that go through a place like that. And I think there's a lot of examples of such things. You know, like somebody just told me about these contracts that are let out for you know, putting, serving the concession stands at a place like Yosemite. You know, a lot of people go through that too. And so, you know, if an agreement can be put into place for indigenous peoples to, you know, run those concession stands and, you know, decide what gets put on those information boards, in those kind of places, then, you know, a lot of people can see that. A lot of people can be exposed to that conversation, and maybe some funding could even be generated indigenous stewardship activities.
All right. And Professor Hankins, do you want to weigh in on that? What are you recommending in terms of how to educate the public, broaden awareness about what's needed here?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of my favorite ways of educating the public is actually through having opportunities for the public to actually see cultural burning and or prescribed burning, and inviting the opportunities for the public to engage in it. So, you know, when I tend to find a first place to burn in a location, a lot of times it's going to be in a place where people can see it and they can drive by it. They see the effects of the fire. They can see the live fire. They can stop and ask questions, those sorts of things. So thinking about listeners in the Bay Area, I think about some logical places that I would really love to see fire happen, like on Angel Island and Mount Diablo and, you know, different places like that, where if we work with local tribes to do that sort of thing, we can have very visible locations where people can see it. There can be a discussion around, you know, why it's being done, the whole ecology of it, and people can actually come out to those places and walk the grounds afterwards to really see the benefits of those burns. And I think that's really an important way of starting to make that transition. I mean, the Bay Area obviously is a great place for that because there's such a large population density. You know, when we're doing burns in more remote areas of the state where a lot of the indigenous burning is taking place currently, a lot of folks aren't being able to see that, so it's hard for them to understand the reasons behind it and, you know, what it actually achieves within the landscape. So I think that's really important.
And Professor Hankins, staying with you, how is California doing now with forest management? California Department of Forestry and Fire has around a $3 billion budget, and Forest Service scientists have long advocated for spending more on fire prevention, including vegetation clearing and prescribed burns. But so far, as I mentioned earlier, we've only burned about 35,000 acres this year. Is that accurate? What is the governor doing on this? What is the general status of what needs to be done to try to improve our forest management here?
Right. Well, I would say, and Bill's aware of this as well, that the state is actually making a lot of policy changes and making a lot of investment into, you know, this current budget year. And so while we're not seeing the effects of those fires just yet in terms of people being able to apply it, within the state's Wildfire and Forest Resilience Action Plan, it outlines targets for prescribed burning by both the Forest Service and CAL FIRE, public entities, private individuals, et cetera. And there's money that's being devoted to that in the state's budget. So, you know, with it being a drought year, there may be a little bit of hesitancy for folks to engage in this sort of thing. There's a lot of work around capacity building that's coming through different programs, such as the Regional Fire and Forest Capacity Program, which is through the Department of Conservation, and different initiatives like that are taking place. So we may not see immediate change, but things are gearing up to make that change. And my only hope is that we get ahead of the curve and start implementing things more than the small acreage that you're talking about for CAL FIRE. You know, a lot of it is going to be on private lands. There's a huge opportunity on private lands, and I think as somebody who lives in the wildland urban interface on property, you know, I use those tools myself, and, you know, the hope is to get others to do that sort of thing so that we don't have the same levels of risk. And it's not that fire is going to stop, you know, if we do a prescribed fire, it's not going to stop a wildfire per se, depending on how old that place has been burned. But it is going to change fire behavior, and that's the kind of thing that we really need to be thinking about, is what is the opportunity to change the outcomes of these fires.
And Bill Tripp from the Karuk Tribe, what's your perspective on how the state is doing on prescribed fire and forest management more generally? Would you like to see more money devoted to this? Are there other steps you would like to see the state government take?
Well, there's one thing that's going on right now that I think it would be good for folks to pay particular attention to is that, you know, the liability issue around prescribed burning and cultural fire use is a phenomenal issue. You know, I mean, you look at companies like PG&E and ended up with a $11.5 billion liability determination in the courts because of their infrastructure cause of fire. Well, that same kind of risk is put on the shoulders of a burn boss or a cultural fire practitioner if they're lighting a fire. And so, you know, though prescribed burns and cultural burns have a very, very low escape rate and an even lower an escape rate that like burns down someone's home, but one of the big things that affects folks like that is people can be charged for the suppression costs if CAL FIRE or the Forest Service come to put out the burn, if you have to call for help. And so so that becomes a disincentive. And so right now there's a bill that's on its way to the governor's desk called SB 332 that helps to provide those liability protections for both cultural fire practitioners and burn bosses, certified burn bosses in the state. And so, you know, it creates a gross negligence standard for those things to protect against being charged for a response. Now, the Southeast has some very lenient liability standards, and that's part of the reason why they're able to get so much burning done. And so I think that's going to be one positive step towards increasing the use of fire in the state. And so urging the governor to sign that bill is something that would be very important to do right now.
Well, Bill, I'm glad you brought up this point about liability. NPR actually had a great piece called Why the South is Decades Ahead of the West in Wildfire Prevention. And one of the factors is liability protection and certification system for the burn managers known as burn bosses, Bill, as you had mentioned. Professor Henkins, wanted to ask you what you would like to see the state do on liability. Do you agree that the South is farther ahead than the West on this topic, on this effort? And what are some of the ingredients that California should be incorporating to catch up here?
Yeah, well, I definitely agree with what Bill's talking about, and I'm glad that he brought up SB 332. You know, in terms of getting around that liability issue, as a burner myself, I've always had to recognize that when I light a fire, I own the fire. You know, if that means that I'm not going to set fire at a time when it would be very likely for it to escape. You know, if I went out there today on a day when in the local area where I'm at, it's over, going to be pushing over 100 degrees and set a fire in the late afternoon, like that would be totally, negligent of me. But, you know, under the right conditions, I know that I can burn very safely and effectively without having the worry of a fire escape. So I think having that kind of shift is going to be huge, hugely instrumental in making that change. As far as we think about, like, for the southeastern U.S., you know, they really never had the issues of fire suppression because most of it's private land. It's, you know, so people were able to continue burning throughout the time when a lot of the areas out west were undergoing fire suppression. And so there's a true culture of fire that's there, that people, you know, expect fire to happen. And I've seen this in other places in the world, like Northern Australia, where it's mostly under indigenous stewardship. People expect to see fire in their neighborhoods. They want to see their neighborhood protected from wildfires later in the dry season. So, you know, people come in and burn, and sometimes it's people who are living in that community, and sometimes it's people who are coming in from other areas to do that. But as far as training and that sort of thing, like where the state is looking to go, and I'll bring up another assembly bill, 642, which is also, in this year's discussion, and hopefully will be going to the governor's desk soon, you know, it's really focused on building the conversations around supporting prescribed fire and cultural fire. So it's it's having the state agencies interface more with tribal practitioners and organizations and tribes and folks who are doing prescribed burns to kind of address some of these issues and get through some of the barriers that are there. And one of those barriers, and you brought it up, is like the training. How do you train people to have familiarity with fire? We have these prescribed burn associations that are springing up across the state. How do we train agency people to know about fire? And at the same time, how do we reconnect tribal folks who maybe haven't had a connection with fire because they haven't been able to burn to that traditional way of burning and so forth? And so some of the things that I'm hoping for, and I know Bill's also interested in this too, is these learning centers, like having places across the landscape. In the Southeast, they have the Tall Timbers Institute, where a lot of people go to learn how to burn. They burn over 100,000 acres a year at the Tall Timbers Institute. You know, if we have those kind of places here in California where our vegetation communities are so diverse, scattered across the state, and people from those local areas can come in and learn about fire and how to burn in an ecologically appropriate way, then we're going to be able to get ahead of this sooner than later. And I'm glad
Professor Hankins, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're out of time. I want to thank you, Don Hankins, pyrogeographer from Cal State Chico. Thanks so much for joining us. And Bill Tripp, deputy director of the Creek Tribes Natural Resources Department. Thank you both, and I'm sorry we have to cut it off. All right. Well, this is your call. I'm Ethan Elkind. I wanted to give a quick PSA here, a reminder for listeners, return your vote-by-mail ballot by September 14th at 8 p.m. Polls will be open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. You can check your registration status, register to vote, or update your registration online at registertovote.ca.gov. If you do not register before the deadline, you can still complete the same-day voter registration process and request your ballot in person at your county elections office or polling location. I want to thank you all for joining us, our guest tonight, today, and I also want to thank Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering the program. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, where you can give us a review, and follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio. Email us with show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. I'm Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for joining us. It's Your Call.
KLW San Francisco, it's 11 o'clock.